he was awoken by voices coming from the Supreme Council chamber. The intervening walls should have muffled them, but his hearing was so enhanced that he could recognise Lord Acres. Taita rose quickly from the couch and went to Eos's spyhole. He looked through it. 8 warriors in full battle dress were kneeling before the dais, in attitudes of subservience and respect. The 2 oligarchs faced them. Lord Acre was on his feet haranguing the men who knelt before him. "What do you mean they've escaped? I ordered you to capture them and bring them to me. Now you say they have eluded you. Explain yourself."
"We have 2,000 men in the field. They will not be at liberty much longer."
The speaker was Captain Onker. He was cringing on his knees before Acre's wrath.
2,000? Acre demanded. "Where are the rest of our troops? I commanded you to call up the entire army to deal with this insurrection. I will take the field at the head of the force. I will find the traitor Tinat Ankut and all his fellow conspirators. All of them, do you hear? Especially the newcomer Meron Cambyses and the strangers he has brought with him to Jari. I will personally oversee their torture and execution. I will make an example of them that will never be forgotten."
He glared at his officers, but none dared speak or even look at him.
"When I have dealt with the ringleaders, I will unleash my vengeance on every incomer in Jari," Aqua ranted. "They are traitors. By order of this council, their property is confiscated by the goddess and the state. The men will be sent to the mines. We're short of slaves. I want older women and children over the age of 12 years placed in the slave pens. The younger children, without exception, are to be put to the sword. Any desirable girls will go to the farms for the breeding program. How long will it take you to muster the remainder of our regiments, Colonel Onker?"
Taita realized that Onker must have been promoted to command the regiment that had formerly been Tinat's.
"We will be ready to ride before noon today, great lord," Onker replied.
Taita listened in consternation. Everything in Jari had changed during his sojourn in the mountains. Now his first concern was for Fen and Meron. Perhaps they were already in Onker's hands. He must make contact with Fen immediately to reassure himself of her safety. But it was vitally important, too, that he make the most of this opportunity to eavesdrop on Acre's plans. He stayed at the peephole while Acre continued to issue orders. He was an experienced commander, and it seemed that his tactics would be effective. However, Taita could make his own plans to counteract them. At last, Acre dismissed his colonels, and the 2 oligarchs were left alone in the hall. Acre threw himself angrily on his stool. "We are surrounded by fools and poltroons," he complained. "How was this insurrection allowed to flourish under our very noses? I smell the odour of the putative Magus Taita of Galala in this," Ektang answered. "I have no doubt that he has instigated this outrage. He comes directly from Egypt and Nefertiti. No sooner do we welcome him into Jari than the country is plunged into the first rebellion in 200 years. 212 years, Acre corrected him. 212, Ektang agreed, his voice crackling with irritation. "But such pedantry serves no good purpose. What is to be done about the rabble-rouser?" "You know that Taita was the special guest of the goddess, and that he has gone to meet her on the mountains. Those who are summoned by Eos never return. We need spare no further thought for him. You will never see him again. Those he brought with him to Jari will soon be arraigned." Acre broke off, and his angry expression cleared. He smiled with anticipation. "His ward, the girl he called Fen, will receive my special concern." Taita saw his aura throw off sparks of lust. "Is she old enough?" Ektang asked.
"For me, they are always old enough," Acre made an expressive gesture.
"Each of us has his own tastes," Ektang conceded. "It is as well that we do not all enjoy the same amusements." The 2 oligarchs rose and arm in arm left the hall. Taita returned to the witch's boudoir and barred the door before he made the first cast for Fen. Almost immediately her sign appeared in his mind's eye, and he heard her sweet voice ring in his head.
"I am here."
"I cast for you earlier. Are you in danger?"
"We are all in danger," she replied, "but for the moment we are safe. The land is in turmoil. Where are you, Taita?"
"I have escaped from the mountain, and I am hidden near the Supreme Council chamber." Even over the ether, her surprise was clear.
"Oh, Taita, you never fail to amaze and delight me."
"When we meet, I will have much more for your delight," he promised.
Are you or Merrin able to come to me, or must I find you?"
"We are hidden too, but only 5 or 6 leagues from where you are," Fenn replied. "Tell us where we must meet you."
"To the north of the citadel a narrow valley is carved into the foothills. It is not far from the mountain road, about 3 leagues from the palace. The entrance is marked by a distinctive grove of acacia trees on the hillside above it. Seen from far off, it is shaped like the head of a horse." "This is the place," he told her, and transmitted an image of the grove to her across the ether.
"I see it clearly," she replied. "Sidudu will recognize it. If she does not, I will cast for you again. Go to the valley quickly, Taita. We have but little time left to flee this wicked place and the wrath of the Jarians."
Swiftly, Taita searched the boudoir for a weapon or some form of disguise, but found neither. He was still barefooted and dressed in the simple tunic, which was filthy with dust and soot and scorched by drops of burning magma. He went quickly to the outer door and let himself through into the empty audience hall. He had a clear memory of the route he must follow to reach the entrance through which Tinnat had brought him on his first visit to the citadel. He stepped out into the corridor to find it deserted. When the oligarchs had left, they must have dismissed the guards. He made for the rear of the building and had almost reached the tall double doors to the rear courtyard when a loud voice halted him. "Hey, you there! Stand and give account of yourself!" In his haste, Taita had neglected to spin about himself a spell of concealment. He turned back with a friendly smile. "I am confused by the size of this place, and I would be glad of your assistance in finding my way out." The man who had accosted him was one of the citadel guards, a burly middle-aged sergeant in full uniform. He had drawn his sword and was striding towards Taita with a belligerent scowl. "Who are you?" he shouted again. "You have the look of a dirty, thieving rascal to me."
"Peace, friend." Still smiling, Taita held up both hands in a placatory gesture. "I carry an urgent message for Colonel Onka."
"The colonel has left already." The sergeant held out his left hand. "Give the message to me. If you are not lying and you truly have one, I will see it gets to him."
Taita pretended to grope in his pouch, but as the man came closer, he seized his wrist and pulled him off balance.
Instinctively, the sergeant pulled back with all his weight. Instead of resisting, Taita went with him and used the impetus to crash with both elbows into his chest. With a shout of surprise, the man lost his balance and went over backwards. Quick as a leopard, Taita landed on top of him and drove the ball of his right hand up under his chin. The vertebra of the sergeant's neck parted with a loud crack, killing him instantly. Taita knelt beside him and began to untie his helmet, intending to use his uniform as a disguise. But before he could get the helmet off his head, there was another shout, and 2 more guards rushed down the corridor towards him with drawn swords. Taita prized the blade out of the dead man's hand and sprang to his feet to face his attackers. He hefted the sword in his right hand. It was a heavy infantry model, but it felt familiar and comfortable in his grip. Many years ago, he had written the manual of arms for Pharaoh's regiments, and swordsmanship was one of his passionate interests. Since then, age had taken from him the force of his right arm, but now it was restored to him, as was his agility and fleetness of foot. He parried the thrust of the first assailant and ducked under the cut of the second. Keeping low, he slashed at the back of the man's ankle, neatly severing his Achilles tendon. Then he jumped up and pirouetted unexpectedly between the two before either could recover. The unwounded man turned to follow him, but as he did so, he opened his flank, and Taita stabbed deep in his armpit, sliding the point of his blade between the ribs. With a twist of his wrist, he turned it in the wound, opening it wide and freeing it from the suction of wet flesh. His victim dropped to his knees, coughing up gouts of blood from pierced lungs. Taita spun away to face the trooper he had crippled. The man's eyes filled with terror, and he tried to back away, but his maimed foot flopped nervelessly, and he almost fell. Taita fainted for his face, and when he raised his guard to protect his eyes, sent a thrust into his belly, cleared his blade, and jumped back. The man dropped his weapon and fell to his knees. Taita stepped forward again and stabbed down into the back of his neck, under the rim of his helmet. The trooper dropped face down and lay still. Taita jumped over the 2 corpses and went to the first man he had killed.
Unlike the others, his uniform was not blood-stained. Swiftly he stripped off the man's sandals and laced them onto his own bare feet. They were a tolerable fit. He strapped the sword-belt and scabbard round his waist, then took the helmet and cloak and pulled them on as he ran for the rear doors of the citadel. He slowed to a walk as he reached them and spread the scarlet cloak to cover his torn, soiled tunic. As he marched towards the doors, he sent out an impulse to lull the minds of the sentries who guarded them. They glanced at him with little interest as he passed between them and went down the marble steps into the courtyard. The parade ground was bustling with the men and horses of Onka's regiment preparing for campaign. Taita saw Onka himself strutting about and shouting orders to his captains. He mingled with the throng and passed close to Onka as he made his way towards the stables. Although Onka glanced in his direction, he showed no sign of recognition. Taita reached the stable yard without being accosted. Here there was the same furious activity. The farriers were reshoeing the horses, the armourers were busy at the grindstones, sharpening arrowheads and blades, and the grooms were saddling the officers' mounts. Taita thought of attempting to steal a horse from the lines, but he realised there was almost no hope of that plan succeeding. Instead, he made his way towards the back wall of the palace compound. The stench guided him to the latrines tucked behind the buildings. When he found them, he looked around carefully to make sure he was unobserved. A sentry was patrolling the top of the walls above him, so he waited for the diversion he knew must come. It was not long before he heard angry shouts from the direction of the citadel. Whistles bleated and a drumbeat signalled the call to arms. The three bodies he had left in the passage had been discovered, and the attention of the garrison was focused on the citadel. The sentry rushed to the far end of the parapet from where he stared out over the parade ground to find the reason for the alarm. His back was turned. Taita swung himself up onto the flat roof of the latrines. From there, the top of the wall was within reach. He took a run and leapt for the lip of the parapet. Then he pulled himself up with both arms until he could throw a leg over. He rolled across the top of the wall and dropped over the far side. It was a long fall, but he rode the shock of landing with braced legs and glanced round swiftly. The sentry was still gazing away from him. The edge of the forest was close by, and he darted across the open ground into the trees. Here he took a minute to orient himself, then began the steep climb into the foothills, using the cover of gullies, long grass and shrubs to hide himself from a chance watcher below. When he reached the crest of the hill, he peered over it cautiously. The road that led up to the cloud gardens was just beneath him. It was deserted. He ran down, crossed it quickly, and took cover in a patch of scrub. From there he could see across to the Horse's Head grove of trees on the next promontory. He bounded down the scree slope into the valley, the loose stones rolling under his feet, and reached the bottom without losing his balance. He trotted along the base of the hill and came to an opening. The valley sides were steep, and he went a short distance into it, then turned and climbed to a vantage point from where he could watch the entrance and settled down to wait. The sun reached its zenith, then began to drop towards the horizon. He saw dust on the road across the valley. It looked as though a large troop of cavalry was riding hard towards the east. An hour or so passed, and then he heard the faint sound of hooves coming closer. He sat up, alert. A small band of riders appeared below him and stopped. Sedudu was at the front, mounted on a chestnut pony. She pointed up the valley towards where Taita was hiding. Meron spurred past her and took the lead. The party came on at a trot. Meron followed closely by a lovely young woman on a grey colt. Her long legs were bare and her blonde hair was tumbled by the wind onto her shoulders. She was slim, the set of her shoulders proud. Even from this distance Taita could see her breasts standing out under the bleached linen of her tunic. The wind flicked aside her golden curls to reveal her face, and Taita drew a sharp breath. It was Fen, but a different Fen from the girl he had known and loved. This was a confident, poised young woman in the first flower of her beauty. Fen was riding her grey colt, and she had Windsmoke on a lead rein behind her. Hilto rode at her right hand. Nakontu and Imbali followed them closely, both mounted and sitting their horses well. They had learnt new skills in the many months he had been away. Taita left the ledge on which he squatted and scrambled down the cliff. He jumped out and dropped down the last steep pitch. The scarlet cloak opened round him like a pair of wings, but the visor of the leather helmet obscured the top half of his face. He landed in the path directly before Merin. With the reflexes of a trained warrior, Merin saw the Jarian uniform and rode at him with an intimidating yell, drawing his sword and swinging it high. Taita had only just enough time to straighten and draw his own weapon. Merin leant from the saddle and hacked at his head. Taita turned the blow with his blade and jumped aside. Merin pulled his horse down on its haunches and dragged its head round. Then he came back at the charge. Taita ripped the helmet off his head and threw it aside. "Merin! It is Taita!" he yelled. "You lie! You are nothing like the Magus!" Merin did not check his charge. He leant out from the saddle and levelled his blade, sighting along it at the centre of Taita's chest. At the last moment, Taita swayed aside, and the point of the sword grazed his shoulder as Merin swept past. Taita shouted at Fen as she rode forward. "Fen! It is me, Taita!" "No, no! You are not Taita. What have you done with him?" she screamed. Merin was gathering his mount under him, bringing its head round for the next attack. Nakonto had his throwing spear resting on his shoulder and was ready to hurl it as soon as he had a clear view past Merin. Imbali jumped down from her horse and hefted her battle-axe as she ran forward. Hilto followed her with drawn sword. Both Fen and Sidudu were knocking arrows to their bows. Fen's eyes glittered like emeralds in her anger. "You have done away with him, you villain!" she yelled. "You shall have an arrow through your black heart. Fen, behold my spirit sign!" Taita called urgently in the ten mass. Her chin jerked up. Then she saw the sign of the wounded falcon floating above his head and blanched with shock. "Nay, nay! It is him! It is Taita! Put up your sword, I tell you! Put it up, Merin!" Merin swerved, then reined his mount back. Fen sprang down from Whirlwind and raced to Taita. She flung both her arms round his neck and sobbed brokenheartedly. "Oh, oh, I thought you were dead. I thought that they had killed you." Taita held her tightly to his chest, her body lithe and hard against his. The sweet smell of her filled his nostrils and made his senses swim. His heart swelled in his chest so that he was unable to speak. They held each other with a silent intensity while the others stared at them in bewilderment. Hilto tried to maintain his usual phlegmatic air, but he was unsuccessful. Nakonto and Imbali were mute with the fear of witchcraft, both spitting to left and right, making the sign against evil spirits. "It's not him," Merin was repeating. "I know the Magus better than any man alive. This young buck is not him." After a long while, Fen drew back and held Taita at arm's length. She studied his face rapidly, then stared into his eyes. "My eyes tell me it is not you, but my heart sings that it is. Yes, it is you, it is verily you, but, my lord, how have you become so young and surpassingly beautiful?" She stood on tiptoe to kiss his lips. At this the others burst out laughing. Merin jumped down from the saddle and rushed to join them. He pulled Taita out of Fen's embrace and wrapped him in a bear hug of his own. "I still cannot believe it. It is not possible," he laughed. "But I give testimony that you wield a pretty sword, Magus, else I would have run you through." They crowded round him excitedly. Sidudu came to kneel before him. "I owe you so much, Magus. I am so glad to see you safe. Before you were beautiful of spirit, but now you are beautiful in the flesh too." Even Nakonto and Imbali at last conquered their superstitious dread and came to touch him in awe. Hilto exclaimed loudly, "I did not doubt for a second that you would come back to us. I knew it was you the instant I laid eyes on you." No one took any notice of this blatant falsehood. Merin demanded answers to 20 different questions, and Fen clung to his right arm and gazed into his face with shining eyes. At last Taita recalled them to stark reality. "There will be time for this later. All you need to know now is that Eos can harm neither us nor our very Egypt again." He whistled for Windsmoke, who rolled her eyes at him coquettishly and came to nuzzle his neck. "You at least recognize me, my darling." He hugged her round the neck, then looked again to Merin.
Where is Tinat?
Magus, he is already on the march for the Kitanguli River. The Jarians have discovered our plans. We must ride at once.
By the time they had left the valley and started towards the plain, the sun was setting. It was dark when they entered the forest, and once again Sidudu was their guide. Taita checked her heading by the stars and found that her knowledge of the land and her sense of direction were infallible. He could devote all of his attention to Fen and Meron. The three rode side by side with Taita in the middle, their stirrups touching, while Fen and Meron described to him all that had transpired while they were apart. Then Taita told them, "While I was in the palace, I was able to eavesdrop on Aker's battle council. He is taking command of the army himself. His scouts have reported the movement of the main body of our people along the road towards the east. He has deduced that Tinat is trying to reach the shipyards at the head of the Kitanguli River and seize the boats there, for he knows that our only escape from Jari is down that river. Tell me where exactly Tinat is now and how many are with him."
"He has about 900 people, but many of the men are sick and weak from the treatment to which they were subjected in the mines. He has only a few more than 300 who can fight. The rest are women and children."
300? Taita exclaimed. "Aker has 5,000 trained warriors. If he catches Tinat, it will go hard with him. Worse, Tinat is short of horses. Some of the children are very young. With them and all the sick, he is moving slowly. He must send a small band of fighting men ahead with all the speed to seize the boats. In the meantime, we must delay Aker," Taita said grimly. "Tinat hopes to give him pause at the Kitanguli Gap. 50 men can hold an army there, at least until the women and the sick are on the boats," said Meron. "Don't forget that Aker has scouts who know the country as well as Sidudu does," Taita reminded him. "They will certainly know of the other route to bypass the gap and reach the boatyards. Instead of waiting for him to come to us, we should strike at him before he expects it." Meron had glanced at Sidudu as Taita mentioned her name. Even in the moonlight, his expression was doting. "Poor Meron, the famous philanderer is smitten," Taita thought, and smiled inwardly. But he said, "We will need more men than we have now, if we are to hold Aker. I will stay to watch the road for him. Meron, you must take Fen with you and ride as fast as you can to find Tinat."
"I will not leave you," Fen cried. "I have come so close to losing you that I will never leave you again."
"I am not a messenger, Magus. You owe me more respect than to treat me as one. Like Fen, I will stay with you. Send Hilto," Meron declared. Taita made a gesture of resignation. "Will no one take an order from me without argument?" he demanded of the night sky.
"Probably not," Fen answered primly. "But you might try speaking gently to Hilto."
Taita capitulated and called Hilto forward. "Ride ahead at first light, as fast as your horse will carry you. Find Colonel Tinat Ankut, and say that I have sent you. Tell him that Aker knows we are aiming for the Kitanguli River, and is in hot pursuit. Tinat must send a small detachment of fighting men ahead to seize the boats at the headwaters of the river before the Jarians can destroy them. Tell him his plan to hold the Kitanguli Gap until all our people have been embarked is a good one. But he must send me 20 of his best men. This is desperately urgent. Hilto, you must lead the men he gives you back along the east road towards Mutangi until you find us. Go now, at once." Hilto saluted and without another word cantered away.
"What we need is an ambuscade where we can wait for Aker." Taita turned back to Meron. "You know precisely the kind of place we're looking for. Ask Sidudu if she knows of one."
Meron spurred forward to Sidudu, who listened intently to his request.
"I know just such a place," she said, as soon as he had finished speaking.
"You are such a clever girl," Meron told her proudly, and for a moment the two of them were lost in each other's eyes.
"Come then, Sidudu," Taita called. "Show us if you are truly as clever as Meron declares you are."
Sidudu led them off the track they had been following and turned towards the great starry cross in the southern sky. Within an hour's ride she had reined in at the top of a low wooded hill, and in the moonlight pointed down at the valley that opened before them. "There is the ford of the Ishasa River. You can see the glint of the water.
The road that Lord Acre must follow to reach the Kitangula Gap crosses there. The water is deep, so their horses will have to swim. From the top of the cliff we can shower arrows and rocks on them once they enter the water. They will have to ride 40 leagues downstream to find another ford.
Taita studied the crossing carefully and nodded. I doubt that we will find a better place.
I told you, said Merin. She has a warrior's eye for good ground.
You carry a bow, Sududu. Taita nodded at the weapon that hung over her shoulder. Can you use it?
Fen taught me, Sududu replied simply.
During your absence, Sududu has become an expert archer, Merin confirmed. It seems there is no end to the virtues of this young paragon, Taita said. We are fortunate to have her with us. They swam the horses through the ford, whose current was strong. Once they reached the eastern bank, they saw that the path followed a narrow, rocky defile between the cliffs. It was only wide enough for horses to pass in single file. Taita and Merin climbed it, and from there surveyed the ground below.
Yes, Taita said, this will do.
Before he allowed them to rest, he went over his plans for the ambush and made each in turn repeat the role he had assigned to them. Only then did he allow them to unsaddle and hobble the horses, fill their nosebags with crushed durra meal, and turn them loose. It was a cold camp because Taita would not allow a fire. They ate durra cakes and slices of cold roast goat's meat dipped in a fiery pepper sauce. As soon as they had finished, Nakontu took his spears and went to stand sentry at the ford. Imbali followed him.
"She is now his woman," Fen whispered to Taita.
"That comes as no surprise, but I trust that Nakontu will keep at least one eye on the ford," Taita remarked dryly.
"They are in love," said Fen.
"Magus, you have no romance in your soul." She went to untie her bedroll from the back of Whirlwind's saddle, selected a sleeping spot in the lee of a rocky outcrop well away from the others, and spread her sleeping mat on the ground with a fur kaross. Then she came back to Taita.
"Come."
She took his hand and led him to the mat, helped him out of his tunic, balled it up and held it to her nose.
"It smells very strong," she remarked. "I will wash it as soon as I have the chance."
She knelt beside him on the mat and covered him with the kaross, then took off her own tunic. Her body was very pale and slim in the light of the moon. She slipped under the kaross beside him and pressed her body to his.
"I am so glad that you have come back to me," she whispered, and sighed.
After a while she stirred and whispered again.
"Taita?"
"Yes?"
"There is a little stranger with us."
"You must sleep now. It will soon be morning."
"I will, in a moment."
She was silent again for a long while, as she explored his altered body. Then she said softly,
"Taita, where did he come from? How did it happen?"
"Miraculously, in the same way as my appearance was changed. I will explain it all later. Now we must sleep. There will be many other opportunities for you and the little stranger to become better acquainted."
"May I hold him, Taita?"
"You are already doing so," he pointed out. She was quiet again for a while. Then she whispered,
"He's not so little, and he is growing bigger and bigger."
A little later she added happily,
"It seems to me that he is already a friend, no longer a stranger. So now there are three of us, you, me, and him."
Still holding him, she fell fast asleep. It took Taita much longer to do the same. It seemed only minutes later that Nakontu woke him.
"What is it?"
Taita sat up. "Cavalry on the road from the west."
"Have they crossed the river?"
"No, they are bivouacked on the far side. I think that they did not want to chance a crossing in the dark."
"Rouse the others and saddle up, but do it quietly," Taita ordered.
In the faintest glimmer of dawn, Taita lay on his belly on the rim of the cliff overlooking the ford. The two girls were at either side of him. On the far bank of the river, the Jarian bivouac was stirring, the troopers throwing wood on the watchfires. The smell of roasting meat drifted to where the three lay. Now the light was strong enough for Taita to count heads. There were about 30 men in the troop. Some were at the cooking fires, others at the horse lines tending their mounts. A few were squatting among the bushes at their private business. Soon it was light enough to make out the features of some.
"There is Onka," Sududu whispered fiercely. "Oh, how I hate that face!"
"Truly, I understand your feelings," Fen whispered back. "We will seek the first chance to deal with him."
"I pray for it."
"There is Aker, and that is Ektang with him," Taita pointed them out. The two oligarchs were standing a little apart from the others. They were drinking from bowls that steamed in the cool morning air.
"They have not been able to contain themselves. They have rushed ahead of their regiments. They will start to cross the ford soon, and when they do so, they will give us an opportunity. If they don't, we will shadow them until Hilto brings up our reinforcements."
"I could put an arrow through Aker from here," Fen narrowed her eyes.
"The range is long and the dawn wind treacherous, my darling." Taita laid a restraining hand on her arm. "If we give them warning, the advantage passes to them."
They watched as Onka selected four of his men and gave them curt orders, at the same time gesticulating towards the ford. The men ran to their horses and mounted, then trotted to the river and plunged in. Taita signalled their movements to Merrin. The four horses were swimming before they were halfway across, struggling against the current and lunging forward again as they felt ground under their hooves. They came out with water streaming from their coats and the equipment. The scouts looked around carefully before they started up the narrow defile. Merrin and his men kept hidden and let them through. On the far bank, the rest of Onka's troops were drawn up in three ranks, standing at the heads of their mounts. They all waited. At last there was a clatter of hooves, and one of the scouts galloped back down the defile to the river bank. He stopped there and waved his arms over his head. "All is clear this side," he shouted. Onka called out an order to his men, who mounted and began to move down towards the ford in single file. Onka remained with the rear guard, where he could better control the crossing, but Taita was surprised to see that Aker and Ektang were in the forefront. He had not expected that. He had thought they would take position in the middle of the column, where they were protected by the men around them. "I think we have them." His voice was tight with excitement. He signalled to Merrin to be ready. At the head of the column, the two oligarchs spurred their mounts into the river. Halfway across, they began to swim, and the file lost its tight formation as the current pushed them downstream.
"Get ready," Taita warned the two girls. "Let the oligarchs and these three riders behind them reach the bank, then shoot any others who try to follow. At least for a short while, until Onka can regroup his men, we will have the oligarchs cut off from the main body and at our mercy."
The current was strong, and large spaces opened in the column.
"Knock your arrows," Taita ordered quietly.
The girls reached into the quivers on their backs. Aker's horse found the bottom and scrambled up the bank. Ektang followed, with three troopers bunched behind him. Then there was a gap in the line, and the rest of the column was still scattered across the river.
"Now," Taita shouted, "shoot the riders coming up behind the leaders."
Fen and Sududu sprang to their feet and drew the long recurved bows. The range was short, almost point blank. They loosed, and the two arrows flew silently downwards. Both struck home. A trooper reeled in the saddle and screamed as Sududu's flint arrowhead buried itself in his stomach. The man behind him took Fen's in the throat. He threw up both hands and toppled backwards into the water with a splash. Their horses turned and collided with those that followed them, throwing the rest of the column into confusion. Aker and Ektang spurred forward into the defile.
"Oh, yes, fine practice," Taita applauded the girls. "Habit them until I give the order to break and run."
He left them and ran down the pathway into the defile. Merrin let the oligarchs enter the mouth of the defile, then he and the two Shaluk jumped up out of the bushes behind them. Imbali ran at Ektang and swung her axe. With that single stroke, she severed the oligarch's left leg above the knee. Ektang shouted and tried to urge his mount forward, but with one leg gone, he lost his balance and fell sideways, clutching at the horse's mane to save himself. Bright arterial blood pumped from the stump of his leg. Imbali ran after him and swung again. Ektang's head jumped off his shoulder and rolled onto the rocky pathway. His nerveless fingers clung to the horse's mane for a few moments longer, then fell open. He flopped sideways to the ground. With a yell, the trooper who was following Ektang rode down on Imbali. Nokontu flung his spear.
It struck the trooper in the middle of his back and transfixed him. The spearhead stood out an arm's length from his chest. He dropped his sword and tumbled out of the saddle. Merrin ran up beside the last trooper in the line. The man saw him coming and tried to free his sword from the scabbard, but before he could get the blade clear, Merrin had leapt up and thrust him through the ribs. He hit the ground with his shoulders and the back of his head. Before he could rise, Merrin finished him off with another thrust in the throat, then turned in pursuit of Acre. The oligarch saw him coming, dug his spurs into his mount and tore away up the defile, with Merrin and Imbali running after him. But they could not gain on him. From above, Taita saw Acre break away. He turned off the path and ran along the edge of the cliff above him, stopped and poised on the lip of the cliff. As Acre's horse raced below him, he dropped onto the oligarch's back so heavily that Acre lost the reins and was almost thrown from the saddle. Taita whipped one arm round his neck and began to throttle him. Acre fumbled his dagger from the sheath and tried to stab back over his shoulder into Taita's face. With his free hand, Taita seized his wrist and they wrestled for the advantage. Thrown off balance by the shifting weight on its back, the horse crashed into the wall of the defile and reared on its hind legs. Locked together, Taita and Acre were thrown back over its hindquarters. Acre was on top as they hit the ground, and his full weight slammed into Taita. The shock broke his grip on Acre's throat and dagger hand. Before he could recover, Acre had twisted round and thrust for Taita's throat with the dagger. Taita grabbed his wrist again and held him off. Acre put his full weight behind the dagger, but could make no impression. Taita now had the abundant strength of a young man, and Acre was long past his physical prime. Acre's arm began to tremble with the strain, and his expression turned to dismay. Taita smiled up at him. "Eos is no more," he said. Acre flinched. His arm gave way, and Taita rolled over on top of him. "You lie," Acre cried. "She is the goddess, the only true goddess." "Then call upon your only true goddess now, Lord Acre. Tell her that Taita of Galala is about to kill you." Acre's eyes flew wide with consternation. "You lie again," he gasped. "You are not Taita. Taita was an old man, but by now he is dead. You are mistaken. It is Eos who is dead, and you who will be soon." Still smiling, Taita tightened his grip on Acre's wrists until he felt the bone begin to give. Acre squealed and the dagger fell from his fingers. Taita sat up and twisted him round, pinning him so that he was helpless. At that moment Merrin ran up. "Shall I finish him?" "No," Taita stopped him. "Where is Sedudu? She is the one he has most sinned against." He saw the two girls racing down the pathway from the top of the cliff. They came up to where Taita was holding Acre. "Taita, we must fly. Onka has rallied his men and they are coming back across the ford in force," Fen cried. "Finish the swine and let us ride." Taita looked past her at Sedudu. "This is the man who gave you to Onka," he told her. "He is the one who sent your friends up the mountain. Vengeance is yours." Sedudu hesitated. "Take the dagger." Merrin picked up Acre's fallen weapon and handed it to her. Fen ran forward and ripped Acre's helmet from his head. She seized a double handful of his hair and dragged his head backwards, exposing his throat. "For yourself and for all the other girls he sent to the mountain," she said. "Cut his throat, Sedudu." Sedudu's expression hardened with determination. Acre saw death in her eyes, and he struggled and whimpered. "No, please! Listen to me, you are only a child. Such a heinous deed will scar your mind for ever." His voice was broken and almost incoherent. "You don't understand. I am anointed by the goddess. I had to do what she commanded. You cannot do this to me." "I do understand," Sedudu answered him, "and I can do it." She stepped up to him and Acre began to squeal. She laid the blade against the stretched skin of his neck just under his ear and drew it down in a long, deep stroke. The flesh opened, and the great artery in the depths of the wound erupted. The breath whistled from his severed windpipe. His legs kicked spasmodically, his eyes rolled back in their sockets, his tongue protruded, and he blubbered strings of blood and spittle.
Taita pushed him away, and he rolled over to lie like a slaughtered pig, face down in the spreading puddle of his own blood. Sedudu dropped the dagger and jumped back, staring down at the dying oligarch. Meron stepped up behind her and placed an arm round her shoulders. "It is done, and it was well done," he said softly. "Waste no pity on him. Now we must go." As they ran to their horses, they heard the shouts of Onka's men at the ford behind them. They mounted and dashed up the defile with Taita and Windsmoke in the lead. They came out on top of the hills and paused to look down on a wide, level plain of grassland that stretched ahead. In the blue distance they made out another line of hills, the peaks rugged and sharp. Sedudu pointed to a break in their silhouette. "There is the Kitangula Gap where we are to meet Colonel Tinat." "How far is it?" Meron asked. 20 leagues, perhaps a little more," Sedudu answered. They turned and looked back to the ford. At the head of his squadron, Onka flogged his horse up the river bank and shouted with anger when he saw the corpses of the oligarchs, but came on all the faster. 20 leagues! Then we have a merry race ahead of us," Meron said. They put the horses to the slope and flew down towards the plain. They reached it as Onka's men came boiling over the skyline of the hill behind them. With a chorus of savage yells, they started down, the white ostrich plumes on Onka's helmet distinguishing him from his men. "No need to linger here," called Taita. "Let us be gone." Within half a league it became apparent that the bay filly Sedudu rode could not keep up with the other horses. They had to moderate their pace to hers. Meron and Fenn dropped back beside her. "Courage!" Fenn called. "We will not leave you." "I can feel my horse weakening," Sedudu cried. "Have no fear," Meron told her. "When she is blown, I will take you up behind me." "No," Fenn was emphatic. "You are too heavy, Meron. The extra weight would kill your mount. Whirlwind can carry both of us with ease. I will take her." Taita rose in the stirrups and looked back. The pursuit was spreading out as the faster horses pulled ahead, the slower ones dropping back. Onka's plumed helmet was conspicuous in the centre of the leading rank of 3 Jarian horsemen. He was pushing hard, closing the gap steadily. As he urged Windsmoke onwards, Taita looked at the mountains ahead. He could now see the notch that marked the gap, but it was so distant that they could not hope to reach it before Onka was upon them. Then something else caught his eye. There was a fine smear of pale dust on the plain ahead. His heartbeat quickened, but he tried to control it. No time for false hope now. It is almost certainly a herd of gazelle or zebra. But as he thought it, he saw under the dust cloud a bright flash of sunlight reflected off metal. "Armed men," he muttered. "But are they Jarian, or is it Hilto returning with the reinforcements?" Before he could decide, there was a faint shout from behind. He recognized Onka's voice. "I see you, you traitorous bitch. When I catch you, I'll rip out your womb. Then I will roast it and force it down your throat." "Close your ears to his filth," Fenn urged Sedudu. But tears ran down Sedudu's face and splattered the front of her tunic. "I hate him," she said. "I hate him with all my soul." Behind them, Onka's voice was clearer and closer as he yelled, "After you have dined, I will have you in the way you most hated. The last thing you will remember will be me inside your bowels. Even in hell you will never forget me." Sedudu let out a racking sob. "You must not hearken to him. Close your ears and your mind," Meron urged. "I wish I had died before you heard that," she sobbed. "It means nothing. I love you. I will not let the swine harm you again." At that moment, Sedudu's filly stepped with its off fore into a mongoose burrow that was hidden in the long grass. The bone snapped like the breaking of a dry branch, and her horse somersaulted. Sedudu was thrown headlong. At once, Meron and Fenn wheeled back for her. "Get ready, Sedudu. I will pick you up," Fenn called. But Sedudu rolled to her feet and turned to look back at the pursuit. By now, Onka was well ahead of the men who followed him. He was leaning forward eagerly, pushing his horse to its top speed, bearing down on Sedudu. "Prepare to meet your constant lover," he shouted. Sedudu unslung the bow from her shoulder and reached for an arrow. Onka laughed with delight. "I see you have a toy to amuse yourself. I have something better for you to play with before you die." He had never seen her shoot. She took her stance and brought up the bow. He was close enough now to see her face clearly. His mocking laughter died as he recognized the deadly anger in her eyes. She drew the fletching back to her lips. He sawed his horse's head round and tried to turn away. Sidudu loosed her arrow. It took him in the ribs, and he dropped his sword to try with both hands to pluck it out. But the barbed head was buried deep. His horse pranced in a circle, fighting against the curb. Sidudu shot again. He was turned away from her, and the arrow struck low in the center of his back. It went deep and skewered his kidneys, inflicting a mortal, agonizing wound. He twisted to reach for the arrow. She shot again, hitting him in the chest, cutting through both lungs. He uttered a sound that was half groan and half sigh, then fell backwards as his horse lunged under him. One of Onka's feet caught in the stirrup, and his horse broke into a gallop, towing him away, the back of his head bouncing over the earth as the frantic animal kicked back with both hind legs at his corpse. Sidudu slung her bow over her shoulder and turned to meet Fen as she galloped up. Fen reached down. Sidudu jumped up and they linked arms. Fen used Whirlwind's speed and impetus to swing her up over the hindquarters. Seated, Sidudu wrapped both arms round her friend's waist, and Fen spun Whirlwind round. The next three Jarians were close upon them, howling with anger at the killing of Onka. Meron met them head on. He cut one man down, and the others broke away rather than risk a collision. They circled him, waiting for an opening, but his blade danced in a glittering arc they could not penetrate. By this time Taita and the two Shaluk had taken in his predicament and were coming at full tilt to support him. "Nobly done!" Taita shouted to Fen as they passed each other. "Now ride for the gap! We will cover your retreat." "I cannot leave you, Taita," Fen protested. "I will be close behind you," he shouted over his shoulder, then plunged into the fray. He hacked one of the Jarians from the saddle, and the other found himself heavily outnumbered, the rest of his squadron still far behind. He tried to defend himself, but Nakontu thrust his long spear into his side, and Imbali swung her axe into his raised sword arm, severing it above the wrist. He broke away and galloped to meet his comrades, swaying in the saddle. "Let him go," Taita ordered. "Follow Fen." With the rest of the Jarian squadron coming up behind them, they raced away. Taita gazed ahead. The band of strange horsemen was much closer now. They were heading directly towards each other. "If they are Jarians, we will fort the horses and stand to meet them," Taita shouted. They would form the animals in a circle, dismounting behind them and using their bodies as a defensive wall. Taita watched the newcomers intently. His eyesight was so acute now that he recognized the leading rider even before Meron or Fen could. "Hilto! It is Hilto!" he cried. "By the sweet breath of Isis, you're right," Meron shouted. "By the look of it, he has brought half of Tenat's regiment with him." They slowed to a trot as they waited for Hilto to come up. This confused the pursuing Jarians, who had thought the interlopers were a detachment of their own forces. They halted uncertainly. "By the wounded eye of Horus, you are welcome, Hilto, old friend," Meron greeted him. "As you see, we have left a few of the rascals for you to test your blades upon." "Your kindness is overwhelming, my colonel," Hilto laughed. "We will make the most of it. We do not need your help. Ride on to where Colonel Tenat Angkut awaits you at the Kitanguli Gap. It will not be long before we are free to follow you." Hilto galloped on with Tenat's men in a tight group behind him. He gave the order, and they extended their line into battle formation. He led them in the charge straight at the milling Jarians. They crashed into them and sundered their ranks. Then they chased them back in rout across the plain the way they had come, cutting them down as they overhauled the winded horses. Taita led his own band on towards the Blue Hills. As they caught up with the two girls on Whirlwind, Meron reined in beside them. "You shot like a demon," he told Sidudu. Anka brought out the demon in me, she told him. Methinks you have paid off all your debts in gold coinage. Now you and your demon can sleep peacefully at night.
Yes, Meron, she answered demurely. But I never wanted to be a warrior. It was forced upon me. Now I would rather be a wife and mother.
A most laudable aspiration. I am certain you will find a good man to share it with you.
I hope so, Colonel Cambyses. She looked at him from under lowered eyelashes. A short while ago you spoke to me of love.
Whirlwind is already tiring under the great weight Fen is forcing him to carry, Meron said seriously. I have room for you behind me. Will you not come across to me?
With the greatest pleasure, Colonel.
She held out her arms to him.
He swung her across effortlessly and placed her behind his saddle. She circled his waist with both arms and laid her head between his shoulder blades.
Meron could feel her trembling against him, and occasionally her body heaved with a sob before she could choke it back.
His heart ached. He wanted to protect and look after her for as long as they should live.
He rode on after Taita and Fen, with Nakonto and Imbali bringing up the rear.